You're on the Plants Grow Here podcast. I'm Daniel Fuller. Come along with me as we enter a hidden world of deep horticultural, ecological, and landscape gardening knowledge with featured experts, industry professionals, and enthusiasts.
Plant taxonomy is a basic aspect of horticulture. It's the science of classifying plants and is every bit as fundamental as plant biology, soil science, and integrated pest management. And yet, so many of us are paid to work with plants every day without ever having been taught it. In this episode, I chat with John Mason, creator and CEO of ACS Distance Education, educator, author, as well as current and founding board member for the Australian Garden Council. He's here to walk us through what plant taxonomy is, how to classify plants using binomial nomenclature, and where we draw the line between what's a species and what's a subspecies or cultivar. Welcome to the show, John.
Yeah, thank you.
So it's going to be a fun one today, getting a little bit academic, but we'll try and bring it down to a tradie level so that landscapers and horticulturists don't get overwhelmed by this because it can be a little bit complicated. But can you start off by telling us what is plant taxonomy?
Well, it's very simple. It's the how we identify plants. It's the classification of plants. It all started back in the 1700s when a scientist sort of saw six or seven different names on the same plant. His name was Linnaeus from Sweden. And he thought, oh, we better do something about this and get the same name on all the plants. Now, of course, it's always a little bit controversial in history. Some people say there was another guy before Linnaeus who set up the idea, but it's basically, look, you look at a plant, you look at the characteristics of a plant. If the characteristics are very similar, well, then it's more closely related. If the characteristics are not similar, it's not as closely related. And we classified plants like that until someone came along and confused it all with genetics. Mm-hmm. And now, of course, you know, you can map the human genome and you can say this person's related to that person or their heritage, they come from people who were Vikings or whatever. Well, you can do the same with plants now, and you can map their genome and work out where they come from. Problem there is if you classify a plant 100% based on its appearance, what we call morphology in science. So if you look at it and you say, look, the leaves are a certain way, the flowers are a certain way and what have you, and then you classify it by its genetics, doing that gene mapping, sometimes there's a conflict there. But look, nothing in life is perfect. And what do you want? Do you want to be able to classify 99.99% of plants accurately using a scientific method and have a few little anomalies? Or do you want to go back to what we used to do? And it's like you can look at a palm and you can say, oh, that's a red palm, that's a big leaf palm, that's a sugar palm, that's a grass palm, that's, and it can all be the same plant. So that's why we use scientific plant taxonomies, so that we can get a closer idea of what we're talking about. If you talk to me about a plant and I talk to you about a plant and you say grow it in this soil or grow it in that soil, we both want to know that we're talking about the same thing. Can't do that with common names. Can do it with scientific names.
That's very well said, John. So the way I think about this is that the tree of life, if you want to call it that, it's like multi-stemming, multi-branching. So it's like as we go back to a common ancestor, we find the different plants branching off. So what you're saying is classifying them by genetics means that we can classify these plants down to a single branch along the tree. But because of the complexity of the just the sheer volume of branching and different ways that plants go, that does make it hard, because it's like, at what point do we call something a separate species? At what point is it just a variety? Or at what point is it a completely different genus?
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's right. You know, look, the basically the way we've classified plants taxonomically is we've put them into a big group where let's just look at flowering plants, plants that produce flowers, for instance. You can split them into two big groups, what we call dicotyledons and another group we call monocotyledons. Now, cotyledons are just those first leaves that come out when a seed germinates. So a dicotyledon is a plant that has a seed. When it germinates, it has two leaves come out at first. So that's why we call it dicotyledon. With a monocotyledon, it only has one leaf that comes out at first. That's why we call it monocotyledon. And all plants fit into either dicotyledon or flowering plants into dicotyledons or monocotyledons. Now, grasses are an example of a monocotyledon. You put in a grass seed, watch it germinate, and you'll see just one leaf pops up first, and then other leaves start coming on after that. If you take, say, a pea and plant that, when it emerges, two leaves come up straight away. So that's a dicotyledon. So we've picked one characteristic. We've split all flowering plants into two groups. Then we split them again according to some other characteristics. So we end up with a multitude of groups, and we keep splitting them down different layers until we get to what we call orders. And that order level, there are quite a few characteristics which are similar to all plants in an order. And for instance, I'll give you an example. A canna is in the same order as a banana, and that's in the same order as a genus. And they all have similar sorts of leaves, and we can see a sort of similarity. And if you look at the flowers on them, they're sort of similar. But that's still a mid-level breakdown into a taxonomic group or a group, scientific group of plants. When we come down one level from the orders, we come down to families. And within a family, within an order, you have a lot of different families. And if you go back to that order that you find your bananas and your cannas and your gingers in, there are actually eight different families in that order. Mm-hmm. Heliconias are another one, costus are another one. So there's a bunch of different families in each order. Now, the key way to get to know plants and be able to identify plants all comes down to learning your plant families, and I'll talk a bit more about that when you ask me some more questions.
Yes. I wanted to touch on the monocot and dicot split. So, yes, we like to classify all plants into a monocot or a dicot. For example, we'll put a magnolia into dicots and we'll put a water lily into monocots. But my understanding, John, is that those two plants are what we call a basal angiosperm or flowering plant, which means that they forked off very early in the story of flowering plants. That means that they aren't quite so simple. Do I have that right?
Yeah, sort of. I think, though, when someone's trying to learn to identify plants, you can worry a bit too much about all the details of the evolution and the higher levels of classification. When I was taught to identify, I want to come back to the families, because when I was taught to identify plants originally, which was way back in 1969 at Burnley when I studied my diploma, we were given plant names and we were given the families and the genus and the species. The genus is the group that is the next level down from the family, and the species the next level down from that. And it's sort of like having a hook to hang a coat on in a cupboard, you know. If you get those basic hooks right, and you only need to learn sort of 50 or 100 hooks, then you've got 50 or 100 hooks that you can hang 10 or 20,000 different plants on. And that makes it so much easier. I can look at a plant these days, and I was. This is how I was taught. I was taught the families. I was taught that back in those days, Compositae, but it's now been changed to be Asteraceae, but basically that family are the daisies. Anything that has a daisy-like flower is in that family. Now, I can walk around and I can see a weed that has a daisy flower, and immediately I know, oh, I've got that hook. I hook it on the Asteraceae hook, and I've got, when you got something to associate something with, it stays in your memory better. It's sort of like you meet a person and you know their father and you remember, oh, that's Bob's son, because you got something to hang the new name
on.
And what you got to do if you really want to learn plant names the easiest way is to build up your hooks, build up your knowledge of the plant families, and then have all these hooks you can hang it on. If you start worrying too much about the details above the plant families and below the plant family level, you're never going to develop the hooks as well. Does that make sense?
It's such a perfect segue into what I wanted to talk about next. And you're absolutely right. We need a reference point when we're trying to identify plants, because we're going to get lost in the clouds if we don't have those hooks, aren't we?
Yeah. That's right.
So have you heard of Thomas J. Elpel and his beautiful book, Botany in a Day?
I can't say I have. I've got about 500 or 600 botany and horticulture books sitting behind me here, but that's not one I can say.
He's, I believe he's definitely in North America. I can't remember if he's in Canada or Canada, as they say, or the US. But his book is so brilliant. I was lucky enough to interview him on my podcast, and he was part of my curriculum when I was at TAFE.
Yeah, look, that, you know, books are coming and going all the time, and plant names change too. When I went through Burnley, we had a different botany book. We dealt with a book called Plant Science by Hartman and a bunch of other guys. Hartman also wrote a book called Plant Propagation. There's another good one that I've got on my shelves, which is a Hartman wrote about 20 years later called Plant Science, Growth and Development. It might have been built on the other book, just looking at it now. But if you're talking books, there are also some really good books like this one out of Melbourne University called Name That Flower. And this is a great one for getting to know your plant families. Have you run across that one?
No, but it sounds like exactly what I'm trying to talk about.
Yeah.
This guy also has a video where he shows you different plant families and how to identify them in terms of, those composite flowers like the Asteraceae, and then some of the differences between them, like whether or not they have the ray petals around the outside.
Yeah.
Or if it's a Brassicaceae member, well, they're always going to have four petals, two short stamens, two tall stamens and four short ones. So it's like you're going to always have these similarities and differences. Actually, I can't remember how many exactly stamens there are on a Brassicaceae, so don't hold me to that.
Yeah.
Because six parts sounds wrong, doesn't it?
I'm just thinking Brassicaceae. I've probably got it here somewhere. But anyway, look, if people want to know these things and they write to you or write to me, I can give them those details. We actually have made about 15 videos of 15 different plant families ourselves.
And you're talking about ACS there, aren't you?
ACS, distance education. If you look that up on Vimeo, We've got a Vimeo channel, and all of those videos are there. And I was rather chuffed when a professor from Oxford University told me that he was using our plant ID videos and our family videos and showing them to students at Oxford Uni. So we've done something right there, I think.
Absolutely. Mm. Yeah, that's a big one.
Yeah, but look, things keep changing with your plant, and we can talk about plant families all day long. Mm. Another good one, easy one to know, is your Lamiaceae family. That's the mint family, mm-hmm. and that's got a lot of herbs in, and it's easy to tell that family because if you look at the stems in cross-section, they say they're square. It isn't exactly square, but they have four distinct sides on the on the stems. So if you're looking at just your common mint, chop that in half and look down on it, and you'll see what I mean. Mm-hmm. But there are other plants in that family. One plant we grow a lot in our gardens is Westringia, and that's in the mint family. And if you chop the stem in half and you look at that, you'll see it's the same. Mm-hmm. And if you look at a flower on a Westringia, another one's a Prostanthra, still in the mint family, another one's thyme, another one's rosemary. Mm-hmm. All of these plants are in the same family. And if you take the stem, chop it in half, look at it, it's four-sided. You know, that's a hint that it's in the mint family. Then have a look at the flowers and compare them. They say they're two-lipped flowers, and by that, a botanist means that you've got two different types, sizes in the petals of the flower. And if you look at a flower on any of those plants in the mint family, you'll see that there is a similarity in the flower. The other thing that's similar is in the mint family you have oil glands in the leaves. Now, you might say, look, Westringia doesn't smell oily. I know rosemary does, and maybe Prostanthra, and maybe mint. But if you get a little magnifying glass and have a look at the leaf of a Westringia, you'll see there are actually little dots when it's magnified, and they're oil glands. They might not be highly scented oils, but they are still oil glands, and anything in that family has that. But you know something about that family? Once you have that hook and you can put something into a Lamiaceae or mint family, I know that mint family plants generally can be propagated from cuttings. Mm-hmm. I know that mint family plants generally like a moist soil. Some of them will tolerate dryness, but if they're going to grow well, they like a moist soil. And you start to find certain characteristics like that. Plants in a certain family will tend to like a similar range of pH conditions in the soil, a similar sort of soil in other ways too. They like a similar sort of nutrition. They tend to be susceptible to similar types of insects and diseases. So if you get to know the family and you can put a plant in a family, you can immediately have some good educated guesses about how you should treat it, where you should plant it, how much pruning it'll tolerate, whether you can prune it hard and it'll shoot back, or whether you've got to prune it a bit lighter, whether it's going to be resistant to this pest or that disease. Of course, there are exceptions, but knowing the family is a step in the right direction to knowing how to grow the plant.
That's absolutely right, John. And I believe that flowers are one of the best ways. You know, you can't really identify a plant family without looking at the flowers, unless it's something like an acacia, which is very different to other Fabaceae members.
I'll tell you what, though, as you get better and better at it, and you learn your families better and better, you do start to get a good gut feeling about it. Like the legumes frequently have divided leaves.
Mm.
And you look at something and you think, oh, gee, you know, that looks a bit like a pea, or that looks a bit like an acacia. It looks a bit like a center. And then you notice, oh, wait a second, it's got divided leaves. Now, one other thing, most of those plants in the legume group, and there's actually three families that, and it was leguminosae, then it was split into three other families, then it was split back, and the taxonomists keep confusing us by moving them backwards and forwards. But all of those plants that produce pod seeds in pods are legumes, and if you look at the roots, they have frequently little nodules on the roots that have the ability to be able to take nitrogen out of the air and feed it into the plant.
Mm-hmm.
So if I've got a plant and I'm thinking, oh, hasn't got flowers, what family is it in? Oh, sort of looks a bit like a senna or an acacia or a pea, or could be that it's in the legume family. Oh, look, it's got divided leaves. Oh, that's a bit of a tip. Maybe it is in the legume family. Oh, I might scratch away at the roots. Oh, look, there are all these lumps all over the roots. They're like the root nodules that I see on an acacia. Yeah, I'm pretty sure that is in the legume family. And that's indeed the sort of process that you go through. But I've been doing this, like I say, since 1969. What's that 55 years? And I'm still learning. But you do start to build up this gut feeling about plants when you start with learning those families, and then you've got that hook to sort of build on right through your career.
Yeah, each plant family has their own kind of personality. So when we're looking at a Westringia flower, it is a different shape to something like a salvia, which is like a lot longer and more tubular. But if you actually look at them closely, you can see the lobes of two different sizes, as you mentioned, and they do actually have a similar shape.
But, you know, salvia is in the same family too.
As Lamiaceae.
Yep, it's a Lamiaceae too.
That's right. So even though they're a little bit different in their shape, they do have a lot in common if you look at them closely.
Yeah, you'll see you've still got that two-lipped flower. And if you have a close look and you cut the stem of a salvia in half, you'll see it sort of has like four sides to the stem looking down on it.
And it has those oils too.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah.
So, and look, some of the ornamental salvias, you smell them and you think, there's no smell in that. That can't have oils. And then you get something like your Salvia officinalis sage, which we use in cooking. And that obviously has a scented oil. Because it has oil doesn't necessarily mean it has to be scented oil. It's just oil.
That's a good distinction. And just because it has a square stem doesn't make it a Lamiaceae member.
No.
It's just one clue.
That's just one clue. But you know, the thing to do is to focus on the families and build up your repertoire of those families and those clues, and then gradually you sort of put it all together, and you end up learning to identify more and more and more plants, and that's the way it goes.
Absolutely. So, John, so far we've been talking about angiosperms, which they say are the most complex plants just because of the way that they flower, and just they say that they're on the – basically, if I think of it like a tree, they'd be on the very top of the outer tips of the tree. Yeah. Then if we go back down, we can see some other large branches that branch off early. So we can start with the lowest branch, which is bryophytes, which are the simplest plants, which are mosses and moss-like plants.
Yeah, well, the other common one are liverworts. And you'll find them if you're out in the bush and you're walking around and you see these flat things growing, which are green, growing over the top of rocks and growing amongst mosses. They're liverworts. And the thing with the liverworts and the mosses is they release what are known as their seeds, but their spore. They call them spore. And new plants grow from the spore. But they release them just from, they just sort of form on the surface of the plant and are released. Whereas those angiosperms, they have their seeds enclosed in a fruit. Might be a dry, hard fruit. It's not always soft like an apple or a blueberry, but the seeds are enclosed. And that's part of why they say they're more advanced. The plants, as they became more advanced, they developed this mechanism to protect the seed. Some spore blows away and an animal can eat it, and that's it. But they've got to get through the fruit to get to the seed in an angiosperm.
That's right. The fruit may just actually be the pod in a seed pod.
Yep, that's right.
Yeah, and sometimes that seed pod will be what we call desiccant or dehiscent. I can't remember the exact term, but it pops open to reveal the seeds.
Yeah, oh, look, there are many different ways that the seeds can be released, and of course, nature is wonderful. Nature's developed all sorts of mechanisms for spreading seeds around. And you've got the wind, you've got water, you've got, as you say, the seeds can dehisce, the pod can just open and drop the seeds. Some seeds, the case that's or fruit that's enclosing the seed might release the seed, and the seed might be that light that it can just blow around in the wind and transfer to miles away.
Or a bird might eat one of your cotoneaster fruits,
yep.
Then sit on your fence and do a poop, and then a new cotoneaster will grow right on your fence line.
Yep, that's right. So that happens too with all sorts of things. Yeah.
So let's continue on with this story of plant complexity. So we start off at the base of the tree of life, or the tree of plant life anyway, with bryophytes. Then we get a little bit more complex when we get to pteridophytes, which are ferns and their allies. Yep. Can you tell us about this? What do you call this, a clade?
Clade. Well, a clade, yeah. I think that's possibly getting a bit complicated to go getting sure. into. But that's just another group classification that you could use. But ferns... look, we used to talk about two kingdoms or three your animal kingdom and your plant kingdom, and you had all of your plants in one kingdom, and you had fungi and you had seaweeds and everything under the sun in that kingdom, and then all your animals from humans right down to the bacteria were considered animals. When I went through college, that's the way it was.
Wow.
But as people have done research and PhD papers and classified and reclassified, those kingdoms have been split into three, four, five, and we keep getting more and more splits in the kingdoms. So your ferns, you could consider, depending on who you follow, because you get different scientists will have gone different distances along the path to reclassifying things. So that's why I say it's 99.999% consistent, but sometimes it's not with your scientific classification, because you will find one scientist in America might say it should be changed to X number of kingdoms, and a scientist over in England is saying, no, we want to keep the number of kingdoms the way it is. And then it comes down to your orders, and they vary on what they say with orders, and they vary with what they say on families. So there are those variations. And, look, when I came through college 55 years ago, all legumes were in the same family, the leguminosae family. And then sometime after that, I can't remember, it might have been the 70s or the 80s, some scientists came along and said, oh, we're going to break them down and we're going to put your cassias and bauhinias and sennas all into a group we call Sace balanaceae. and we're going to put your Poulteneas and your peas and various other things into a group. Kinnetias, Hardenberges, they're all in a group we call Mimosaceae. And then we're going to put your wattles in Mimosaceae and those other ones into Fabaceae. And then a little bit along the track, they put them all back together again. And then a bit more along the track, they split them up again. So we can't go getting too precious about these little changes. But, you know, a legume out there that's producing acacia seeds or Poulteneas seeds or pea seeds or cassia seeds, it's not going to change the way it does things. But us scientists are going to stuff around with the way we see it and the way we put it all together. Am I going off track a bit here? But,
a little bit. And I want to get back to pteridophytes. But first, there is a it's a kind of an intellectual battle going on between the lumpers and the splitters.
Yeah, well,
or is that an oversimplification?
Yeah, I think it is a bit of a simplification. You've really got to understand the very high level of academia and what happens in academia. And for us as gardeners and landscapers, we're going to be concerned about whether we can get a good price and make a profit on the next job we do. For the people who are classifying plants, who are sitting in a botanic garden somewhere as a taxonomist or are sitting at a university somewhere, those guys, they're getting research projects, and that research is being funded often by governments, sometimes by the universities. And if they can come up with an idea to split a plant family up, or split an order up, or split a kingdom up, or lump it all together, and they can give a good argument for that, then they can get funding. And that means they've, like us getting a garden job, they've got a job for the next 3 or 4 years to split everything up, produce some papers and put it to the scientific community and get it accepted.
And then make us upset because we have to call the Achmenas a syzygium.
And look, sometimes you find that even though they might do academically a very good job, and it might reveal some more characteristics about the plants that we didn't understand or didn't know so well in the past, those changes confuse people. I remember a friend who was working for a plant label company, and I'm talking 30 years or more ago, and there was a split with a particular group of plants, and I said, "So are you going to change the printing of all your labels?" And he said, "Oh, God, no. We've got enough labels printed to call that plant what it's called now for the next 10 years. So we'll just keep selling the old labels to nurseries until we run out. And if they haven't made a change again then, we'll make the change then." So you got that dynamic at play. You've got the academics doing their thing. And just to complicate it a little bit more, I've got to tell, I told you this story at the AIH conference, and I've got to tell this one. Many years ago, I was asked to write a book on tropical plants. And I thought, well, and that's when I was living in Melbourne. And I thought I better go to the tropics and get some photos and talk to some people and do a bit of research. So I took a trip to Hawaii and I got in touch with a colleague who was a professor at the university in Honolulu. And he said, "Oh, come and see me and I'll take you down to the botanic gardens at Honolulu and I'll introduce you to the director." So here am I, a young guy, well, relatively young. I think I was in my mid-30s then. And I went down to Honolulu Botanic Gardens and we looked around for half an hour before going in to see the Botanic Gardens director. And we ended up seeing a plant, and this botany professor said, oh, that's interesting and blah, blah, blah. And I said, but they've got it named wrong. And he said, no, it's right. And mm-hmm. I said, no, they got the family name wrong on it. And we went to lunch and met the director, and I thought, oh, I'm going to tell him this. So I said, hey, you've got one of your plants labelled wrong. They label it a different plant family at Melbourne Botanic Gardens. And he said, oh, no, no, I've got it labelled right. Remember, we're in the United States, and I came from South Africa. And South Africa and the United States follow the International Horticultural Congress on plant naming, whereas you over in Australia and the people in England follow the International Botanical Congress. And while the two congresses, by the way, represented by elite taxonomists from all of the world, while the two congresses largely agree, there are occasions where they don't. So, and then that got me thinking, what about if you go to other languages? You know, are the Germans following the Americans or the English? And what about the Japanese? And, oh, for goodness sake, what about the Russians and the Chinese? What are they following? It complicates it, but what's the other option? 25 different common names for the same plant.
Exactly. In our endeavour to correctly and collectively name these plants, part of it is a scientific thing. Obviously, it's very scientific. But then at a certain point, it becomes an opinion, doesn't it, about what's a different genus and where do we draw the line between a species and a variety?
Definitely. Look, Linnaeus, when he set up the system, and what I was taught too, is what a genus is. When you have two plants which will crossbreed with each other, that's a species, when they crossbreed very readily. When you have two plants that might occasionally crossbreed, that could be a genus. When you get up to the family level, they're not going to crossbreed. You know, that was the sort of rough distinction that was given. And of course, you know, you'll find different people will have different criteria and put it down different ways at different points in time. But it's all interesting, and it keeps your mind active.
Is that what we're aiming for here, just to keep our minds active, or are we looking for a way that we can say, no, no, I want Westringia furticosa planted here, or I want 20 of them?
I think what it is we are looking for a way where we can communicate with each other and get a relative consistency in identifying plants, and we can also heighten our power, our observation of the plants. The one thing that getting into plant taxonomy does, it makes you look at the plants more closely. And I find, you know, we teach horticulture, and I find if I teach someone about leaves and the difference between, say, an opposite leaves and alternate leaves on a stem, and then you ask them to go out and observe those things, it makes them have a close look at the plant, and they tend to remember that plant because they've studied it closely. If you ask people to count up the number of petals on a plant and look at whether the petals are joined together at the bottom or not joined together, that makes them look at the plant too and differentiate between this plant and that plant. There are all sorts of key characteristics like that that keep cropping up over and over again. Another one is the superior ovary or inferior ovary. Now, the ovary is where the seeds form. It's what happens is when a seed forms, you get a bit of pollen comes from one plant, it lands on the top of the flower, and it grows down to the bottom of the flower where there's a female part, and that pollen's male, and that fertilizes the female part at the bottom, and then that female part starts to grow into a seed and then produce a fruit around it to encase it. Now, at the point where the petals join the base of the flower, if that fertilized seed is developing below that point where the petals join, we call it an inferior ovary. And if it's above where the petals join, we call it a superior ovary. And whether a flower is superior or inferior tends to be a characteristic that sticks with the family. You pick a family, and usually everything in that family either has an inferior ovary or has a superior ovary.
Just one more clue.
One more clue. And there are lots of little clues like that. And as you get to know the different families, you start to see these different clues. And then you start to see, gee, if I understand inferior and superior ovary, and if I understand alternate and opposite leaves, and if I understand fused petals or not fused petals, once you understand a dozen or a couple of dozen characteristics like that, then when you go and look at a plant, immediately you look for these telltale characteristics and you put them together and you start to see that pattern. And then, oh, it's probably in this family. You know what, too? People try to identify plants by just flipping through a book. But hell, I've got books where there are 5,000 plant photos in a book, and if that book has the plant family names in, I only need to flip through maybe 20 or 30 different photographs, because I can look at it and I can say it's in this family. Uh-huh. So go to page 150, flip through the next two or three pages, work out what it is. But if I don't know my plant families, I've got to wade through 5,000 photos and try and remember what I'm doing all the way through in order to match it up to a photo.
That's absolutely right. And I wonder if anyone can relate with me when I sort of say that I remember a time in my life when I looked at a plant, I saw a plant, and when I looked at a flower, I saw a flower, and it didn't really get much more specific than that. And then over time, you learn to break plants into different categories. And it's like now if I look at a particular flower, I might say, 5 petals, fused stamens to the pistil, that looks like a Malvaceae family member.
Yeah.
And then it's like you break that down.
Yeah, that's the way it goes. That's the way it goes. And, you know, what does worry me is people who are growing plants not knowing what they are.
Oh, and they sell them with the wrong label.
Yep, that. and what's even more dangerous is, and I'll tell you another little story, there are two different types of kale. One type of kale is toxic, and you've really got to get rid of the toxins and cook it if you're going to eat it. And the other type of kale, you can eat it, it's not so toxic and you can eat it raw. And I was walking past a juicing shop once and I saw they had kale that they were putting in juices and they had the wrong type of kale.
Right.
Now, it made me think, you know, if people are growing vegetables or any edible plants and they get it wrong, you only need to have, you know, the wrong species, something close, but the wrong species, and it might be the difference between dishing up something that is toxic or something that is tasteless or something that isn't commercially viable. Things grow to different sizes too. You can have different plants in the same genus or the same species even, which can grow to a whole variety of different heights. And you're looking at a plant and you don't quite know what it is and you think, oh, I grew something like that before and it grew to 1 meter tall. I'll put that there up against this wall. And then you come back a few years later and the thing is 8 or 10 metres tall because you got the wrong cultivar there. So
that's right.
You know, it is really important. I had someone today even who was saying to me, oh, I've got a back wall and I've had some dracaenas growing on it. No, yuccas. Mm. I've had yuccas growing on it and they're damaging the walls. So we thought we'd pull that out and we'd put a sugar palm in there.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, what do you mean sugar palm? Oh, I don't know what sugar palm is. So we looked up sugar palm and the first thing that came up was Dipsis, the genus Dipsis. And then I said, what species? And they grow different heights and different sizes. And then we said, well, what about other palms that could be called sugar palms? And I found something else in one of my books that was called a sugar palm. And, you know, it all started to become very dangerous for them. And I said, well, why don't you go for tiger grass instead? Yeah. So that's what they're doing.
It gets murky, doesn't it? I've been working with Ausbreed. They have a bunch of different Callistemon viminalis cultivated varieties. Now, one of them, Better John Callistemon, grows up to about 1.2 meters high, where a Slim Callistemon will grow up to, you know, 3 meters plus. So it's just same species, but just different breeding and genetics can just create such a different plant.
Yeah, and look, things, you'd be surprised how they can vary from one part of the country, even when they're indigenous, from one part of the country to the other. I do remember I went to an international plant propagators conference years ago. I'm talking about back in the 80s. Mm. And there was someone from Israel talking about growing Eucalyptus camelgulensis, the river red gum.
Beautiful plant.
At that particular conference. And they said, look, we collected seed from river red gum from Victoria, New South Wales, Queensland. I think, if I'm not mistaken, even right up into the Northern Territory. Mm. And he had all of the, like, hundreds of different sources of river red gum. And he said, we planted all these hundreds of different cultivars from trees of the same species. And he said three of them grew well in Israel and the rest failed.
And did he tell you where the three were from?
You're asking me to remember back 30, 40 years now. Probably did if you go back and
somewhere
look
dry
up the old IPPS conference papers. But the reason I raise that is just to show you and reinforce what you just said, that you can get a lot of variation in the same species, even and the same species can grow across a wide range of different climates too.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and going back to breeding again, you know, you might say, oh, Callistemons don't do well with wet feet. Well, actually, Ausbreed have bred those viminalis cultivars that I mentioned, Better John, Green John, and Slim Callistemon. They all do well in, like, serious flooding. So that's breeding. Then you might have, like, one variety of a plant in a natural habitat where it's like the genetics at the top of the hill and the bottom of a mountain start to get separated because different genetics are being selected for within that environment.
Yeah, look, I've got some Callistemon viminalis self-seeded indigenous growing in a creek at home.
Right.
And
there you go.
And the roots of some of those plants are sitting in water most of the year. Mm. And yet I've seen Callistemon growing in country towns that go through drought and the same plant can be in bone dry soil through drought for years and years and it survives.
Absolutely. Yeah. And the perfect plants for urban landscapes can do both of those. Oh, I mean, perfect plants. What are we talking about here? If we're talking about something like a rain garden or a bioswale that needs to hold on to its life through severe wet and severe dry through different periods, whether you're going through La Nina, El Nino, or whatever other weather pattern's going on, you know, they need to do both in certain circumstances.
Yeah, that's right.
Anyway, we have taken a bit of a detour. I just want to get back on track again. We were talking about bryophytes, and then we talked about pteridophytes. So bryophytes are mosses and liverworts and their allies. Those are the two main ones.
Yeah.
Then we have a bit of a change in terms of, like, pteridophytes or ferns. They get a bit more complex because now all of a sudden they have a vascular system.
Yeah, well, a vascular system simply means that you can have the nutrients flowing up and down through channels inside the plant. But, yeah, that's a little more complicated as a plant. And ferns still don't produce their seeds or spores, to be accurate, inside any sort of structure. But they are a little more complicated in terms of having that vascular system. You can go from ferns then to conifers, which are even more complicated again, and they do have something that encloses the seed, but in a cone, not the same sort of structure that we have on a flowering plant, which is a fruit. So your conifer, that next group up that has cones or cone-bearing plants, conifers are the dominant group. But you also have your cycads in that group, which are an ancient group and an offshoot to the conifers.
So when we're thinking about this tree of plant life, We've mentioned these four major branches that come off, which are bryophytes, pteridophytes, gymnosperms or conifers, and then angiosperms or flowering plants. And then each of those major branches then branch out several times until we get to plant families, genus, and then species, which would be like the leaves on the very tip.
Yeah, well, not quite.
Okay.
Almost. We also talk about varieties and cultivars,
right,
and we use various terms like that. Subspecies are technically the next group down, so species can have subcategories. We call them subspecies.
Very true.
Yeah. The name variety or the name cultivar often get thrown around with the name subspecies as being almost equal. And I suppose in rough terms, most people sort of think, okay, it's a type of species. And they all are. A cultivar means something that's been cultivated. Man has grown it. A person has grown it. So if you want to be strict about it, if you've got something that you're growing, it's a cultivar. And a cultivar could be a species. It could be a genus. We're not really referring to a category. We're just referring to something that is being cultivated.
So can I just add one thing there?
Yeah.
So if I go and get a seed from nature, from the bush down the block, and then I plant it in my garden, at that point it becomes a cultivated variety.
Yeah. Well,
I see. If I gave it a name and then I registered it for plant rights, then we can get into a whole other ball game, which I'll touch on soon, but we won't go too deeply into that.
Yeah, look, the plant naming thing, if you think of it like intellectual property.
Yeah.
And intellectual property is a whole other, like I could do a whole podcast on intellectual property. Generally speaking, under international law, if you create something, you own it. But the problem is proving you own it. So if you go and plant that seed and it grows up and you get 10 plants out of those seeds and you choose one to keep propagating, that becomes a cultivar, and it becomes a cultivar of a variety which you own. But if someone else comes and pinches it and starts selling it under their name, you have to be able to prove that you actually own it. So unless you've done genetic mapping on it and registered that under some sort of scheme like Australia's Plant Variety Rights Scheme, or you've given it a name and registered the name so you actually own the name. You might not own the actual genetic property, but you own the name that it's being sold under. Then you can't really take legal action. You've got to have proof to take legal action.
I think there's going to be some people listening right now who are saying, you can't, like, own a plant, man. But, you know, I like my Hass avocados. If we just had the original avocados that we had 100 or, you know, 500 or 2,000 years ago, it wouldn't taste the same as this variety. Now, yeah. Without being able to register the plant breeder rights on that Hass avocado and that breeder being able to take a small cut off of every single sale, we would have boring plants. And the same goes for plants in our amenity sector, like that slim callistemon that I mentioned earlier. It's really narrow and has a very columnar shape. Now, if the plant breeder that I work for, Ausbreed, couldn't make a small cut off of every plant that's sold at a nursery, there would be no incentive for us to breed these new cultivated varieties. And then, you know, we'd have a less variety of plants.
Not only less, but you wouldn't have as good a plants.
Yeah.
I refer back to a conference I went to many years ago where there was a German nurseryman talking. And this I was amazed. This German nurseryman said the German nursery industry turns over X amount of dollars a year, or Deutschmarks or what, euros, whatever. And he said 50% of that turnover goes into paying for plant variety rights.
Wow, that's a big chunk.
Yep, but you go to I've been to three big garden shows over the years in Germany, and they have some fantastic plants that I don't see elsewhere. Sometimes I do, sometimes I don't. But they've got a massive industry, and they identify what the market wants. They identify what's needed. Like, we're trying to green our cities now, and we've got polluted cities. How do we get plants that we can plant in a polluted city and it will tolerate that pollution and thrive? Mm-hmm. The only way is to breed them, select them, work out which ones are good. That costs money. It costs time. And unless there's a reward for doing that, a financial reward, no one's going to do it.
Absolutely. So, John, what's the difference between these cultivated varieties that we said and just like a general variety from a species level just that we find in the bush?
Well, the variety in the bush is adapted to where it's growing. Mm. So you go into the bush and you've got certain climate conditions, certain soil conditions, and you look at those conditions and you think, oh, gee, my backyard's the same sort of conditions. Well, take a seed off it or a cutting and grow it, because it'll probably grow well in your backyard.
As long as you have the right to do so.
Well, you know, some plants are protected in the bush. So, but then some plants which are protected in the bush, you can get permits to collect the seed too.
That's right. So I guess that instead of being bred by humans, like, you know, we say, oh, I like the red color of this flower, but I like the rootstock of this plant, so we're going to, you know, pollinate this one with that one, and then hopefully we get the best of both worlds, or we'll put out 10,000 seeds and the one that looks the best for what we want, then we'll select. I guess nature's doing that too, isn't it? Because it's like, well, this is a wet area. The only plants that are surviving here can survive with wet feet. Therefore, the genetics over time changes ever so slightly. So whether it's a root system or whether it's the leaves are slightly darker green or bigger or something like that, these slight variations occur.
Yeah, well, you know, when you get seed pollinated, you get genetic mutations, you get slight changes in things. You're not identical to your father and mother. Mm. A plant is not identical to its father and mother either. And you might do some things better than your parents did and other things not as well. And the plant can do some things better than its parents did and other things not as well. And the whole task of a good horticulturist is to know their plants, be able to pick out the right plants and be able to create the appropriate conditions to get the best out of those plants.
Yeah, and so buying plants or planting seeds by seed, it's never guaranteed. The plants can be different, completely different from one another, or they can be very similar. We can never really know. Some plants are obviously more uniform. Some others have more genetic variety or variants. But then if we take a cutting or by tissue culture, this is not genetic modification, but it's always going to be the same plant because we're cloning a plant from the same genetics.
That's right. If a plant is grown as a clone, if it's grown from an asexual means, then you're going to get identically what you had with the parent. But if you grow it by seed, you may have some variation, but if the seed has been produced under controlled conditions, you may be able to produce seed which has minimal variation because you can control who the father is and who the mother is. And when it comes to, say, grass seed, that's the way the turf companies produce it. They have to have some sort of control over what they're producing, so there is predictability in how the turf is going to grow. With some of your flower seeds, that's the way we do that too. There needs to be a predictability in what you're producing. You can't do that. The other alternative is, okay, you try and produce grass seed for a lawn, one plant at a time, cloning, and then planting it out one plant at a time in a lawn. Just imagine how many plants you need for the lawn on a front, say a bowling green. You know, that's just not practical. So we do choose to use the sexual seed production for certain plants because it's practical. In some instances, we find ways to do that controlling who the parents are and what we get.
Yeah, very true. So the pronunciation of plant names, especially the Latin and the Greek, particularly the Latin, like how fussy do we have to get there, John?
Okay, you don't need to get fussy about it. Some people do. People worry about this so much, but I remember early in my career people like botanists saying to me that the system of scientific plant classification was contrived to write plant names and communicate correctly through writing. It wasn't contrived to communicate through speech.
Right.
So that's one point to take on board. So don't go getting too precious about it. The other thing is that plant naming was right from the beginning based on Latin and Greek language. So there is a logical argument to say the pronunciation should follow traditional Latin and Greek pronunciation. So if you want to follow something, do that. But, you know, look, I grew up in Melbourne. I went to Burnley. I was taught pronunciation of all sorts of different plant names. I moved around Victoria and everyone pronounced them pretty much the same as I did. And then I went over to England and set up a business there and started talking to people in the industry over there, and I found quite a few plants that were just pronounced completely different.
Mm-hmm.
And then I traveled to America and I found the same thing there. You've got different pronunciations used in different parts of the world. If just remember what scientific plant classification is about. It's all there for us to be able to communicate and know what plant we're talking about. What's it matter if we pronounce words just slightly differently in different parts of the world? We can all learn from our experiences and the experiences of others, and let's not get hung up too much on the pronunciation.
Yeah, that's well said. I wouldn't let the inability to pronounce something correctly, in inverted commas correctly, stop you from trying to learn the scientific taxonomical names of plants.
No, and look, sometimes one of the worst things about being uncertain about pronunciation and is questioning yourself and not being confident to say what the plant name is. Now, there is one little trick now with all this modern technology, which I didn't have when I started out. If you're not sure and you want to be a bit more confident about it, do a search on the internet. Just type pronunciation angophora or pronunciation eucalyptus or whatever the plant name is. There are audio recordings for just about everything you're likely to find. You know, follow that if you don't want to follow anything else. But don't go criticizing someone else because they pronounce something wrong. They need to be confident about it too.
That's well said. That's a good point. So now seems like a good time, John, now that we're over an hour into this interview, to talk about the actual names of plants. So I guess we have a binomial nomenclature system where they have two names. So it's like Eucalyptus caesia or caesia, depending on how you want to pronounce it, or caesia. So we have eucalyptus is the genus name, and then caesia or caesia, however you want to pronounce that second name, is what we call the epithet. Can you break down what I'm talking about there?
Well, that second name, in that case, if you're uncertain whether to say caesia or caesia, you either are fine. But if you really want to worry about it, go back to the Greek and the Latin. And Eucalyptus caesia is named after Julius Caesar.
There you go.
So you work out how you want to pronounce it from there. So there are little hints like that in words that are sort of out there in Latin and Greek that you can pick up on.
I get ficifolia. Ficifolia, I feel very resolute that it's ficifolia because it's folia that resembles a ficus, whereas some people say ficifolia.
Yeah, well, I was taught in Melbourne ficifolia, and when I went to England, they were saying ficifolia. So as I said, don't get too precious about it.
So can you tell us about the plant names then? So that binomial system, can you tell me, like, what's the first word and what's the second word and what do they mean?
Well, as I said before, you've got plants all broken down into families, and then the families are broken down into the genera. The plural for that is genera. The singular is genus.
So it's not genuses?
Not genuses. It's genera or genus. Now, genuses are very smart people missing an eye.
What do you mean by that?
Well,
oh, genius. Okay, gotcha. So that's what a genus is. So what's the epithet then?
Eucalyptus is the first word. Now, when you're looking at, say, Eucalyptus caesia or acacia, all of those words are words that just scientists have put on them at various points in time. And the way they've got the words is basically someone has thought that sort of makes sense. It relates to this, that, or the other. Sometimes it gives a hint at the some sort of characteristic of the plant, but we don't see it because they've given the hint in Greek or Latin.
Like Phacopholia.
Yeah. The interesting thing about that too is there's a convention that we should spell the first name, the genus, beginning with a capital letter.
Yeah.
And the second name should be spelt beginning with a lowercase letter.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how I was taught to do it.
Me too.
And then I started picking up American books that spelt some of the species names with uppercase letters.
Oh.
And the reason they were doing that was because if it was named after a place or a person, so say our famous Australian botanist, Botanic Gardens person from Melbourne, Baron von Mueller, there are lots of plants named after Mueller. So, for instance, Baronia Muelleri. Now, in Australia, we would say Baronia Muelleri, capital B, and Muelleri, lowercase m. But in America, they'd say, oh, Mueller was a person and he was a very prestigious leading botanist, and it's a bit of a slant on him to go and use his name and not use a capital letter, so we'll put a capital letter in it.
Wow.
So you've got a little bit of a difference between certainly between America and Australia. I've got a book called Hortus Third, which was produced over a long period of time by a team of botanists at Cornell University, and it is very, very botanically accurate. And Hortus Third have all the species of named after places and people, all starting in capitals.
That's very confusing, John. I hate that.
Well, you know, it's just one of the peculiarities. Another thing about writing your genus and species name is the convention, traditional convention, is you always write it in italics. The problem is a lot of people write things out with a pen and paper, and how many of us are good at writing, differentiating between italics and normal writing when we're writing with a pen and paper? And then sometimes I'm dealing with technology and the technology doesn't allow me to write in italics. And that becomes a little bit problematic. You would think all the computer nerds out there in the world would think about us botanists, wouldn't you?
You would have thought so. I would have. John, there's also the fact that with cultivars and varieties, the naming can be a little bit different. Like the way I was taught in TAFE is to put the cultivar name at the end and have it in speech marks, in inverted commas. So it'd be like Salvia, whatever the species is, Hot Lips. Can't remember the species, Salvia something, Hot Lips. Whereas with Ausbreed, who I'm working for now, they'll have the cultivar name at the start and they'll treat it like an adjective, like a describing word. So it's like Slim Callistemon viminalis. And it's like the slim is at the start. And there's a reason why they do that for plant breeders' rights, but it escapes me now. And I don't know if you know why that is.
Well, yeah, look, there are legal reasons we do things and there are marketing reasons we do things. Like I said before about one of the plant label companies that wasn't going to print the new plant name for 10 years because they didn't want to not have sales on a warehouse full of labels.
Not just that, but people don't know the new names yet. It hasn't filtered down to the tradies.
No, well, you know, that is part of it too. Who are your customers? Are they tradies? Are they nurserymen? Are they botanists? Are they landscape architects? And plant knowledge varies from one place to another. We don't have enough plant knowledge around. That is a major, major problem. I do have to say when I went through Burnley in the late 1960s, early 1970s, there were a lot of botany degrees. You could go and do a major in biology at a university and you could do a major in botany. So that means that was your major area of study. And over the last 50 years, the number of options for doing botany as a major has decreased dramatically in Australia.
Oh, yeah.
And also the teaching of plant taxonomy has decreased. When I went through and studied at Burnley, we had to learn 3,000 plant names. We had to be able to know the families, the genus and the species, and where necessary, the variety or cultivar for 3,000 different plants. I know there are accredited courses in Australia now in where you can get away with as few as 50 or 100 plants for an accredited horticulture course. We don't do that. We still try and keep the plant names up in our school, but there's a lot less plant taxonomy taught. I think what has happened over the years is more people are studying and there's still just the same amount of money there to teach people to study, and there are a lot more workplace health and safety regulations that you have to learn and a lot more other things you have to learn, and something has to give. And unfortunately, the thing that's given in the teaching of horticulture has often been plant taxonomy.
So I guess that's the watering down that we often hear a lot of the old heads talking about.
Yeah, well, that's right, but these things go in cycles, and you know, if I mentioned before about people doing juicing with a toxic kale, you only need a few instances of people being poisoned, and you find there starts to be a bit of a new thinking about what we should be doing. I'm on the board of the Australian Garden Council, and we were just talking last week about an idea that I've seen overseas. You can walk around some cities in some other parts of the world and you'll find even just along the streets there are signs on trees and signs on shrubs saying this is a Rosa gallica or this is a liquid amber styraca flua or eucalyptus caesia or whatever. And I think that's one way that we might be able to improve our plant taxonomy knowledge in Australia if we manage to convince some politicians to pay for signs to go in gardens and on streets or where people are walking past them and seeing them every day of the week.
Absolutely.
You know, that's just one thought. But I think if we're going to cut our plant taxonomy out of our courses and we're going to still keep growing lots and lots of different plants, it's like you're asking for trouble. Down the track, you're going to be planting the wrong plants in the wrong places and you're going to be getting problems coming back and biting you way down the track. You'll have trees that are too big, ripping up the concrete and the asphalt in roads. You'll have drainage pipes getting clogged up by plants that are growing into them because we've got the wrong plants there. And worst of all, you're going to be feeding people toxins. so we really do need to give some attention to it. I do have to say, though, that one thing we have that we didn't have decades ago is some really good TV that's educating people on plant names. When you look at your Gardening Australia and Garden Gurus and Better Homes and Gardens and all those shows, and they're out there throwing all the plant names out, and that's got to be sifting through into people's heads a bit too.
Absolutely. Yeah, it's invaluable. I can't believe that we're not focusing more on plant taxonomy. It is fundamental. It's every bit as fundamental as your botany, your biology, as your soil science. It's a fundamental.
Yeah, it is. It's a cornerstone. And, you know, in the national curriculum for horticulture, it specifies what people should learn when they're studying vocational education with respect to plant names. I haven't looked at it for a number of years, but I do remember a number of years ago looking at it, and it said, the student shall identify plants. That's all it said.
Yeah, that's a weed identified.
Yeah, and I had I've encountered people who teach plants at TAFEs, at RTOs, at universities, at various colleges, and I've encountered people who've said, well, we really only need to get them to identify a couple of plants and show us they can do that, and they've satisfied the curriculum. Mm. But we're going to make sure they learn at least 300 or 400 plants. Mm. So you've got teachers who are doing that, but then unfortunately you've got a few people who game the system, I guess. I might not be popular with them saying this, but it is possible for someone to only teach 2 or 3 plants. Mm. I do remember encountering a teacher who will now be retired, probably 15 years ago, and he told me that the college he was teaching at, the principal of the college came in and asked him to stop teaching plant identification and replace the subject with bricklaying, because under the government's policies, bricklaying would earn more money for the college than plant identification would earn for the college. Yeah. Great. So we've got bureaucratic hiccups like that have caused problems. When you make problems, sooner or later someone wakes up to them and they get corrected, but you can have a bit of damage in between.
Absolutely, John. So that's what this episode's all about. It's all about just getting a taste. If TAFE never taught you, or if you've never been to TAFE, hopefully this just helps you out a little bit. And you'll still need to go on that journey of learning that we all do, but hopefully this has just given you a bit of direction.
Start with the families.
Yeah. So, John, the next thing that we would be talking about would be, how do we identify a plant? Now that I've found one, I don't know, like, what's the next step? But I don't think we're going to have time to do that. That's a whole other episode.
Yeah, well, that's right. There are lots of different ways to do that. And if all else fails, you go to your nearest botanic gardens, if it's important enough to you, and they'll have a herbarium or taxonomists working at the herbarium, and they'll do it for you, but they might charge you.
Yeah. So we talked about plant keys and a few other ways to identify plants in episode 13 with Stuart Williams. So if you'd like to learn a little bit more about that, maybe head there. And John, maybe we can even talk a little bit more about how to use this taxonomy to actually classify plants one day.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, go in depth to it. Because even with Stuart, I didn't go too in depth into it.
Yeah, well, the only thing about keys is you've got to find access to them. And I've got a library full of good books because before the internet came along, I bought all the books with all the keys in. Mm. I treat them like gold.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And not just having the resources, having the terminology to be able to use the resources, like, is this leaf glabrous? Well, I don't know.
Yeah. Well, that comes back to studying botany, which underpins your plant taxonomy. So people do need to learn more about botany too.
That's another one, isn't it?
Yep.
Fundamental. Do you know your monocots from your dicots, which is also taxonomy too, but do you know what a vascular system is? Do you know why we can ring bark this plant but we can't ring bark that one?
And do you know the biochemistry of plants? Do you know what photosynthesis does? Do you know respiration? Like, there's you never stop learning.
That's the way, mate. And then learning a million plants as well on top of all of that.
Yep. Well, you try. You keep going. But it's It's exciting. Look, I'll tell you what, if you want to live for a long time, get into horticulture and plants. Look at the likes of Peter Kundal, who was well into his 90s before he said goodbye. So, and I've known a lot of old gardeners like that, active till the end too.
Yeah, mentally sharp.
Yep.
Yeah, that's what we aim for.
That's
good for your soul. John, thanks so much for a great chat, mate. I really appreciate your time and your insights.
You're welcome. We'll see you soon, Daniel.
If you'd like to learn more about plant taxonomy, I'd recommend you check the show notes for details on studying online at ACS. They have a range of courses depending on your learning goals and available study time. While you're doing that, chuck on episode 18 of Plants Grow Here to listen to Stuart Williams and I talk about classifying plants with scientific names. Or if you're chasing something completely different, chuck on episode 179, Lessons from Europe's Famous Gardens with Ash Walker. Or maybe it's time to learn about basic soil science in episode 2, Intro to Soil Science with Dr. Samantha Grover. You'll never learn everything to do with horticulture, but every day is a chance to upskill just a little bit.